Buck pointed to chairs, poured drinks like a robot, actually apologizing for the untidiness, and said he wasn't quite settled in yet. And then he very carefully sat down and tossed back his large whiskey in one, and at once sprang to his feet again and said, "So for fuck's sake, talk! Convince me that I haven't cracked!" Harry calmed him down and very quickly explained everything, or almost everything, but without going into the fine details. And when he was through, "So we've come to see you to find out what's going on, what it is that you and E-Branch are up to. Actually, I'm pretty sure I already know, so I'm counting on you to keep them off my back until I get done with what I'm pledged to do." Finally, Clark closed his mouth and turned to stare hard at Jordan. Jordan, yes, looking exactly as Clark had always known him, but still he took the other's hand and squeezed it and stared even harder just to be 100% sure. But in the end, there was no way round it. This could only be Trevor Jordan. The telepath suffered Clark's astonished scrutiny and made no complaints as this old friend of so many years' standing checked him out, checked every well-remembered line of his face and form. Jordan's face was fresh, oval and open, and, with his fair, thinning hair falling forward over grey eyes, it would normally look boyish, except that now it was lined with worry and not a little astonishment of its own. His feelings were reflected in the line of his mouth. Naturally crooked, it would tighten and straighten out if something was wrong, which was how it looked now, straight and tight. Well, and Clark would well understand that. And Clark thought, "Good old easy-going Trevor. Transparent as a window, readable as an open book. Such has always been your guise, anyway, as if you'd like people to be able to read you as easily as you read them. Like you were trying to compensate for your metaphysical talent, or even apologize for it. Trevor Jordan. Sensitive but always determined. I never met the man who didn't like you. And if there was such a one, why, you'd simply avoid him. And if you really are you, you'll know exactly what I'm thinking." Jordan grinned and said, "You missed out the handsome, rangy-limbed, athletic bit. And what's this about boyish? You calling me a big kid, Darcy?" Clark sat back in his chair and touched his feverish brow with a trembling hand. He didn't know which one of them to look at, Harry Keogh or Trevor Jordan. Finally he said, "What can I say, except welcome back, Trevor." After more drinks, it was Darcy's turn. He told them what he knew, which wasn't much, and finished up. "So Paxton must have reported how I sent you the files on those girls, Harry, which was sufficient to get me suspended. As for them coming after you, you know how the branch works almost as well as I do. Of course they'll be coming after you sooner or later." Trevor said, "And me?" "No," Darcy told him, "because tomorrow, first thing, I'll go into town and put them in the picture. I could phone the minister responsible right now, but at this hour he wouldn't thank me for that. So I'll go in and speak to everyone who is anyone in E-Branch and make sure they fully understand what's going on. It might do the trick and get them off Harry's back for a while." "I hope it gets them off my back," said the necroscope unemotionally. "I really do." And he took off his dark glasses and asked Darcy to dim the lights. When E-Branch's suspended boss saw Harry's face in the darkened room, he quietly said, "Harry, I hope so too, for their sake, every last one of them." Harry supposed that Darcy was genuine, supposed he was one of only a few men in the entire world who he could trust. But the necroscope's vampire weirdness was strong in him now, and looking at Darcy Clark, he saw a man who was half friend and half enemy. Harry couldn't read the future, not with any certainty, and in any case knew that prognostication was a dangerous game, fraught with paradoxes, but he could make a damn good guess at what was coming. If he had to stay here in this world longer than he'd planned, if this task he'd set himself took longer than just a few more days, then it could well be that Darcy would be obliged to join the other team. Darcy was an expert, and as Harry's metamorphosis progressed, the branch would need all the expert help it could get. Eventually, one way or another, even Darcy would turn against him. He'd have no choice. Sooner or later, the plague carrier would have to be destroyed. It was as simple as that. "Darcy," Harry said as he turned the lights up again, If we ever did come up against one another, why, you'd be just about the only one who could stop me, for which reason I'm half afraid of you. You know I'm a telepath now, but I wonder, would it bother you if I took a closer look inside your mind? Darcy's talent sensed no danger. Of course not, for Harry intended him no harm. What he did intend was to take out a sort of insurance policy, one which could be cancelled later when the danger was past. No harm at all to Darcy Clark the man, only to his talent itself, for that was what the necroscope feared, to come up against Clark knowing he couldn't win, that the deflector's guardian angel would protect him. But with his talent taken away from him, Clark would be impotent, at least for what remained of Harry's term here. Afterwards, he would give it back to him.
"Look inside my mind," Darcy repeated him.
Harry nodded. "With your permission, but it has to be your own free will." Darcy read nothing into the necroscope's words.
"But can't you read my mind, just like Trevor here?"
"This is different," said Harry. "For this you need to invite me in, as if your mind was a door which you were opening for me." Darcy shrugged.
"Anything you say."
His eyes met the others and locked on them, and in another moment Harry was into his mind. The mechanism Harry sought wasn't difficult to find, and he saw at once it was a freak, a mutation. It was Clark's unique talent, which all of his life had protected him from external dangers, but was impotent to save itself from the internal danger which was Harry Keogh. And even if it could save itself, it did nothing, because Harry meant no harm. There was no trigger Harry could jam, so he simply wrapped the entire mechanism in a fragment of Wellesley's blanket. The job took as long as it takes to tell, and then it was out again. And he was satisfied that Clark's guardian angel had been gagged, for the time being at least.
"Is that it?" Darcy frowned. "Are you satisfied I'll do you no harm?"
"Absolutely," Harry said to himself, while outwardly he merely nodded.
"Because if you try, you'll have no protection, which means I'll at least be able to protect myself."
And then he heard another voice in his head, Jordan's, saying,
"Which means he's no longer protected from anything. Won't you at least tell him what you've done?"
"No," Harry answered. "You know Darcy. He'd become paranoid about his safety in a moment. That was always his paradox, that despite this weird talent of his, still he looked after himself like he was accident-prone or something."
"Well, I hope he'll be all right, that's all," said the other.
"Well?"
"Well?"
Darcy prompted Harry.
"I'm satisfied you won't go against me," the necroscope told him. "And now we have to be on our way."
Jordan said, "It strikes me as likely that the branch will know we've been here. If you want to stay on their good side, Darcy, you might like to call the duty officer and confirm it. Let them see that you're not in collusion with us, and at the same time you might use your good offices to clear me." Darcy pulled a wry face.
"Actually, my offices aren't looking any too hot right now," he said. "But certainly I'll give it a try."
He looked at Harry.
"So where are you two off to now? Or shouldn't I ask?"
"You shouldn't ask," Harry answered. "But I'll tell you anyway. We're tracking your serial killer. I sort of got hooked up on it. That's the job I wanted to finish before I move on." Darcy nodded.
"That way you'll leave a clean sheet behind you, Harry, which is the way it should be. You'll always be the right sort of legend, famous instead of infamous."
Harry said nothing. Fame, even infamy, didn't concern him. All that mattered was his obsession. What was more, he knew why it had become an obsession. He was being chased off his territory, forced to vacate his very own world, which he had fought for. Not physically driven out, not yet anyway, but soon. And the vampire, especially one of the Vampiri, is tenacious and territorial. Frustrated almost beyond endurance, Harry was fighting back. But if he must take it out on someone, then at least let that someone be a fiend in his own right. Namely, the serial killer, the necromancer, the torturer of Penny and those other poor innocents. Even Pamela Trotter, innocent, yes, compared to him anyway. It was time Harry and Trevor Jordan were on their way. They said the usual farewells, very simply, and Harry told Jordan to close his eyes again. Darcy Clark watched them go, and, When they were no longer there, held out his trembling hand in the space where they'd passed through a Mobius door into nothing. And that was all he found there. Nothing. Chapter 2. Finding Johnny. In Edinburgh, it would soon be dawn, but Harry Keogh knew that things, all sorts of things, were rapidly coming to a head, and he wasn't nearly ready to ease off now. Now that he'd started this job, his one thought was to get it finished, in darkness or, if needs be, in light. Early summer sunlight would be a problem from now on in, but it was more of an inconvenience than a threat proper. The sun wouldn't kill him, not yet anyway, but taken in large doses it would sicken and weaken him. His glasses helped keep its glare out of his eyes, his floppy hat protected his head and face but was a dead giveaway. He must keep his hands in his pockets for long periods, which gave him the slovenly look of a delinquent youth or a Labour politician, but was absolutely necessary. Only the British weather, almost invariably mean, was on his side. Trevor Jordan, on the other hand, suffered no such restrictions and could come and go as he pleased, and, with Harry's help, go as far as he pleased and instantly. In the Necroscope's Bonny Rigg house, they drank coffee. Harry would prefer good red wine but needed a resupply, and split the list of Frigis Express depots down the middle. They would work through them, alphabetically, until they found what they were looking for. Jordan would take the day shift with Harry supplying the transport. Harry would do nights with Jordan for lookout. The telepath had asked what was the big deal with this job, and Harry had showed him a series of vivid mind pictures, taken from Penny Sanderson and Pamela Trotter, and now Jordan was as eager as he was. There was a monster loose in the world, and he had to die. "There'll be night watchmen in these places, I'm sure," Jordan said, studying his half of the list. "But at this hour of the morning, they'll be kipping off, asleep in some secret corner. We could do a few of the depots right now, before the drivers or packers or whatever get in." "The bloke we're after is a driver," Harry said. "He uses the M1 and possibly the A1 or A7. Maybe we should start with depots close to those major routes." Jordan had been glancing through the files on the murdered girls. Penny's report seemed to interest him greatly. Ignoring what the Necroscope had just said, he asked, "Harry, did you know Penny's body was found in the gardens under the castle's walls?" Harry frowned. "Yes. Is that significant?"
"It could be," the other answered. "There are quite a few small, specialised units housed in the castle. For all we know, our man from Frigis delivered meat to the various messes and cookhouses at night, and when the coast was clear, he bundled Penny over the wall."
Harry nodded. "I'll check out the exact spot where she was found. I remember looking over the wall. There are places where it rears over grassy ledges and steep banks, where the drop is only a few feet, and if she fell or was tossed, her body might slip and slither a bit without breaking anything or suffering any real damage. Because apart from the damage and suffering he had caused her, she wasn't in bad shape." His gaunt face had turned angry as he remembered Penny as she had been the first time he saw her. Shaking his head to dismiss the memory, he growled, "Anyway, I'll look at it. If it seems at all likely or even possible, well, it could be you've narrowed down the field a little." "Thanks, Trevor." And then ruefully, "As you can see, I'd never have made the grade as a detective or even a common or garden policeman." "Listen," Jordan told him, "you drop me off in Edinburgh right now and let me follow it up. Let's face it, you've been seen in the castle. People may remember you, but they don't know me. I'll take this file with me. I still have an old E-branch identity card I picked up from the flat. It's as good as a policeman's uniform for getting me into places to gather information. Then, while I concentrate on this end of the job, you can get on with checking out the list of depots." Harry saw the sense of it. "All right," he said, "and we'll meet back here tonight. Meanwhile, we can easily contact each other if anything breaks. But you have to understand that the sun hampers me. It might stop me getting through to you, or you to me. On the other hand, if the day is dull, everything will be okay. The only thing is..."
He paused uncertainly. Yes, Jordan waited. You'll be on your own, the necroscope continued. If the branch decides to move in on me, they'll be picking up my friends too.
But picking them up? Jordan repeated him. Not picking them off. And anyway, Darcy said he'd take care of that.
Harry nodded. But he can't take care of the fact that I'm a vampire. And you know the branch won't be taking any chances, Trevor. In fact, I'd lay you odds that my warrant has already been issued, and that right now they're busy closing off any bolt holes. For now, they'll probably lay off this place, because it's mine, and I know it better than they do. But sooner or later, even this house of mine won't be safe. Hell, it would be the perfect place to settle with me. Out of the way, alone and lonely. Morbid's not the way to go, Harry, the other told him. Let's for now just try to find this Johnny, right? Plenty of time then to sort the rest of it. And the necroscope knew he was right, all except the plenty of time part. The following morning, the minister responsible called Darcy Clark into E-Branch HQ. When Clark walked into what had once been his office, the minister was seated at his old desk, and Geoffrey Paxton was standing in one corner of the room, arms folded across his chest and with his back to the reinforced glass windows. Clark could do without Paxton picking at his mind, but he was no longer in a position to complain about it. After apparently casual nods of greeting or acknowledgement, the minister remarked how ragged Clark looked, to which he replied,
I was up late. In fact, I just managed to snatch an hour or two when your office called to arrange this meeting. Well, that was good, for I was coming in anyway. You see, last night I had a couple of visitors, except I'm afraid you're not much likely to believe me when I tell you who one of them was.
Paxton spoke up at once.
We know who they are, Clark, he said sourly. Harry Keogh and Trevor Jordan. Vampires.
Clark had been ready for that. He sighed and turned to the minister.
Do we have to have this meathead in on this? I mean, if he must forever be wriggling about like a fucking great maggot in people's heads, can't it be from a distance, say right outside the door here?
Unruffled, the minister stared right back at him.
Are you saying that Paxton is wrong, Clark?
Clark sighed again.
I saw Harry Keogh last night, yes. He's right that far. So you're saying that Keogh and Jordan aren't vampires?
The minister's voice was very quiet. Clark looked at him, looked away, chewed his bottom lip, and the minister prompted him.
They are vampires?
Clark faced him again and said,
Jordan isn't. But Keogh is.
Clark snapped.
But you were already pretty sure of that, right? All thanks to...
He glanced fire at Paxton.
To this slimy shit? Yes, Harry's been contaminated. He picked up this bloody thing, protecting us, every single one of us, doing a job out in the Greek islands that I had asked him to help us with. So that in my book, at least, he's not about to turn killer now. What more can I tell you?
We think quite a lot.
Paxton answered, but softly now, his pasty face reddening from the sting of Clark's insult. Clark looked at him, looked at the minister, and felt no rapport. He wasn't getting through to them at all.
Why don't you let me tell it my way? He pleaded. And why don't you try listening to me? Who knows, you may even learn something.
But Paxton said,
Yes, and we might get thrown right off the track, too.
Clark glared at him, looked at the minister across his desk, and said,
Look, your pet parrot here isn't making much sense. Shit, I don't understand a word. Do you know what he's raving about?
The minister came to a decision, gave an abrupt nod, and said, Clark, I'm going to give it to you straight. E-Branch was monitoring your place last night. Yours and Jordan's both. You see, we knew even before you did that Jordan was back from the dead, which is to say, undead.
What? A man dead and gone, yet up and about among the living? Undead? That's how we see it, the only way we can see it. And not only Jordan, but one of those murdered girls, too. Vampires, for there's nothing else they can be.
Clark desperately cut in.
But if you'll only listen to me...
But the minister wasn't listening.
We know what time Keogh got to Jordan's flat, the time they left it together, and the fact that however much we don't know, and even if you hadn't admitted as much, still we'd be absolutely sure that Harry Keogh is a vampire. How can we be so sure? Because he carries all the stigmata. You could say he even smells of vampire, which is to say he covers himself in mind smog. Do you follow me so far?
Well, of course I do, Clark answered, feeling his desperation increasing by leaps and bounds, knowing that the minister was building a case. But what sort of a case? Against whom? He had to take one last stab at getting through to him.
But can't you see that even in this you're wrong? With all due respect, you don't know anything about vampires. You've had no experience with them. You're not even talented. You only know what you've read or heard from others, and hearsay can't make up for experience. See, this mind smog you're talking about is something Harry can't control. He doesn't cover himself with it. It just is. It's a result of what he is. Like a dog has a tail, Harry has mind smog. It isn't deliberate. In fact, he would get rid of it if he could, for it's a dead giveaway.
The minister looked questioningly at Paxton, who nodded, however, grudgingly. Or perhaps it wasn't so much a grudging nod as a grim one, a nod of affirmation. And even as his apprehension went up another notch, so Clark said,
"So you see how easy it is to make mistakes."
Unblinking, unwavering, the minister said,
"All vampires have this mind smog, right?"
Clark did blink, however, as his nerves started to jump. There was nothing to fear here, for his talent would warn him of it. But still his nerves were jumping, and he answered,
"As far as we know, yes," he answered. "All of them that we've dealt with, anyway. When a telepath tries to scan a vampire, he gets mind smog."
"Darcy Clark," the minister's face was white now,
"it must have taken a lot of nerve to come here. Either that, or you're a madman, or you really don't know what's happened to you."
"Happened to me?" Clark could feel the tension building and didn't know what it was about.
"What the hell are you talking? You have mind smog."
Paxton spat the words out. Clark's jaw dropped.
"What? I have?"
The minister raised his voice.
"You out there, Miss Cleary and Ben, you can come in now."
The door opened and Millicent Cleary stepped inside, with Ben Trask right behind her. The girl looked at Clark and her voice was breathless as she said,
"It's true, sir. You have it."
She had always called Clark sir. He looked at her, backed away a step, and shook his head. But Ben Trask said,
"Darcy, she's telling the truth. Even Paxton is telling the truth."
Clark took two hesitant steps towards him, and Trask narrowed his eyes, backed off, and held up his arms to warn him off. Clark saw the look in his old friend's eyes and couldn't believe it.
"Ben, it's me," he said. "I mean, with your talent, you have to know that I'm telling the truth, too."
"Darcy," Trask answered, still backing away, "you've been got at. It's the only answer."
"Got at?"
"Without you knowing it, you believe you're telling the truth, and on the other hand, that would be enough to throw me. But it's 2-1, Darcy, and you've been pretty close to Harry Keogh."
Clark spun on his heel, looked at the faces surrounding him. The minister, white as chalk, behind his desk. Paxton, grim-faced, his right hand nervously playing with the lapel of his jacket. Trask, whose talent had never once let him down until now. And Millicent Cleary, still respectful, for all that she'd just accused him of being a monster.
"Crazy. Every damned one of you,"
Clark shakily husked. He thrust his left hand in his pocket, brought out his branch ID and tossed it onto the desk.
"That's it. I'm through with all this. Finished with the branch for good. I'm walking."
He reached with his right hand inside his jacket and dragged his issue 9mm pistol into view. And Paxton yelled,
"Freeze!"
and aimed the gun which he had produced just a moment earlier. Astonished, Clark turned towards him, turned his empty gun toward him too, and Paxton squeezed off two shots. Simultaneously, with a deafening pause, Millicent Cleary and Ben Trask yelled,
"No!"
Too late, for Clark had been hurled back halfway across the room by the first bullet, then swatted from his feet and tossed against the wall by the second. His gun went flying as he crumpled to his knees against the bloodied wall, and his hand crept tremblingly to an area over his heart. There were two holes in his jacket, both turning red and dripping through his twitching fingers.
"Shit,"
he whispered, and
"What?"
He fell forward onto his face, rolled over onto his side, and Trask and the Cleary girl went to their knees beside him. The minister was on his feet, aghast, holding on to the edge of the desk to keep from falling, and Paxton had come forward, his gun still at the ready, face pale as a sheet of paper with holes punched out for eyes and mouth.
"He had a gun," he gasped the words out. "He was going to use his gun."
The minister said,
I thought he was trying to hand it in. That's what it looked like to me."
Ben Trask cradled Clark's head, moaning,
"Jesus, Darcy, Jesus."
The girl had unbuttoned Clark's jacket, torn open his crimson shirt, but the blood had almost stopped pumping. Clark looked down disbelievingly at his chest and the red life leaking out of him.
"No, not possible,"
he said, and the fact was that yesterday it wouldn't have been.
"Darcy, Darcy," Trask said again. "Not possible,"
Clark murmured for the last time, before his eyes filmed over and his head lolled into Trask's lap. And as yet, no one had even called for a doctor or an ambulance. For long seconds the tableau held, until Paxton broke the silence with,
"Get away from him! Are you crazy? Get away from him!"
Trask and the girl looked at him.
"His blood," Paxton told them. "You have his blood all over you. He'll contaminate you."
Trask stood up, and the horror slowly cleared from his eyes, the horror of what had happened. But his horror of Paxton was something else.
"Darcy will contaminate,"
he started to repeat Paxton, and took a long loping pace towards him.
"His blood will contaminate us?"
Paxton backed off.
"What the hell's wrong with you?"
"Darcy was right," Trask snarled. "About you."
He pointed at the minister responsible.
"And you."
He took another pace after Paxton.
"Back off,"
Paxton warned him, waving his gun. Trask caught his wrist and twisted it, and his strength was furious. The gun went clattering to the floor.
"He never spoke a truer word," Trask said, holding Paxton at arm's length like a piece of stinking, rotten meat. "You don't know anything about vampires except what you've read or been told. You have no experience of them. If you did, you know that bullets don't stop them. Not for long, anyway. But poor Darcy there. If you had any talent at all, you'd know that he's stone dead. And you killed him."
I...
Paxton struggled, but he couldn't free himself from Trask's grip.
"Contaminate?"
Trask grated through clenched teeth. He drew Paxton close and rubbed Clark's blood into his hair, his eyes and nostrils.
"Piece of shit! What could contaminate you?"
He drew back a ham of a hand and bunched it into a fist and...
"Trask!"
the minister snapped.
"Ben, let Paxton go. Let it be. What's done is done. An accident, maybe. A mistake, possibly. But it's done. And it's only one of several things we're not going to like doing."
Trask's fist hung in midair, shaking with its need to crash into Paxton's face. But as the minister's words sank in, so he tossed the telepath away from him, and lurchingly, almost drunkenly, he went back to Clark's crumpled, lifeless body. The minister said to Paxton,
"Get a doctor and an ambulance."
Then he saw the look on Paxton's face. The telepath had recovered both his wits and his nerve. He was cleaning his face with a large pocket handkerchief and shaking his head. His look said,
"Think what you're saying, what you're doing."
And out loud he said,
"You don't need a doctor or an ambulance, just an incinerator. Clark's for burning, by us, right now. Right or wrong, we can't take any chances with him. He's for the fire just as soon as possible, and me, I'm for bathing. Trask, Cleary, I know how you must feel, but if I were you..."
"No, you don't know how we feel."
Ben Trask looked up at him, all emotion gone now from his face.
"Anyway," Paxton continued, "I'd bathe if I were you, and right now."
The minister indicated the door.
"Go on, then,"
he told Paxton.
"Go and arrange disposal." Do it now and take a shower too if you feel it's necessary. Then report back to me."
And after the telepath left the room, past the gaping espers where they crowded the corridor,
"Ben," said the minister, "the killing has started. Right or wrong, like Paxton said, it started. And we both know it has to go on. So from now on, I want you in charge of this thing. I want you to run the entire show until it's sorted out one way or another."
Trask stood up, leaned against the wall, looked at the minister and thought,
"One way or the other? No. It can only be one way, for the other is unthinkable. Well, someone has to do it, and I'm as experienced as any of them. More than most, and at least if I'm running it, I'll know that that idiot Paxton won't be doing any more damage."
In the old days, it would have been Darcy, Ken Layard, Trevor Jordan, and a handful of others, and Harry, of course. But this time, they'd been hunting Harry himself. And that was different. And despite what Clark had said, it looked like they'd be hunting Jordan, too. And the girl, Penny Sanderson. Jesus, according to the file, she was just a kid. But an undead kid.
"All right,"
said the minister. And Trask sighed and answered with an almost imperceptible nod. Yes, it was all right, and Paxton could well be right, too, if there had been something, anything at all, wrong with Darcy. Trask looked at the girl, her bloodied hands and blouse.
"Shower," he said simply, "and make a good job of it."
Then, when he and the minister were gone, he said, "When Darcy's been burned, we have to scatter the ashes. Scatter them far and wide." He gave a small shudder. For the fact is, Harry Keogh does things with ashes, and I really don't think I ever want to see Darcy again. Not on his feet, anyway.
9:40 a.m.
Harry Keogh had just finished examining the personal files at Frigis Express's Darlington depot when three things happened simultaneously. One, the depot clerk, whom Harry had lured from his tiny box of an office with a bogus telephone call, returned unexpectedly. Two, Harry felt a pang, almost a pain, of a sort he'd never experienced before within his chest, as if someone had doused his heart with ice water. And three, the fading echo of an unrecognized cry bounced off his mind to ricochet into an unreachable, metaphysical limbo of its own. And it seemed to the necroscope that whatever its source, it was intended specifically for him, as if his name had been called from the gulf between life and death. Dead speak? But this had been different. Telepathy? Well, maybe. Or a cross between the two. That seemed more likely, and Harry remembered how his mother had described the feeling in her own incorporeal heart when a pup called Paddy had been killed by a car on a Bonnyrigg road. So, had someone died? But who? And why had he cried out to Harry?
"Who the fuck are you?"
demanded the burly, shirt-sleeved, red-headed clerk as he herded Harry into the shadows of a dusty corner where the metal filing cabinets met the wall. He gaped at the former contents of the cabinet, now spilling across the floor. Harry barely glanced at the man's suspicious, mottled face and said,
"Shh! Shush!"
the other repeated him disbelievingly.
"You'll get shush, brother, breaking in here. Now what's the score?"
Harry was trying desperately to hang on to the diminishing ethereal echo of a cry for help. Was that what it had been? "Look," he told the very untypical clerk.
"Be quiet a minute, will you?"
He tried to push him.
"Why, you!"
Blotches of angry red appeared on the man's jowly cheeks.
"A con and a thief, right? I recognise your voice. It was you on the phone, right? Well, you picked on the wrong man this time, thief!"
He grabbed Harry by the lapels and looked like he was going to butt him in the face. The necroscope continued to concentrate on the cry and at the same time reached out and caught his assailant by the throat. With one huge hand he held him at bay, choking, and with the other he reached up and took off his dark spectacles. The clerk saw his eyes and choked all the more, and commenced windmilling his arms as Harry shoved him effortlessly backwards, driving him across the floor. Finally, the clerk's legs hit the edge of his desk and he sat down in a plastic paper tray, shattering it with his fat backside. Still Harry held him, and still he listened for a repeat performance of the cry. But it was gone now, probably disappeared forever. Harry felt anger expanding inside him, felt frustrated, cheated, and his hand on the clerk's windpipe was like iron. His nails bit into the man's flesh like it was putty, and Harry knew that if he wanted to, he could crush his Adam's apple and tear his throat out all in one. What's more, the thing inside was urging him to do it.
Do it!
But he didn't. Instead, he swept the clerk from the desktop and sent him crashing down among the debris of his shattering chair and wooden wastepaper basket.
My God! God!
The clerk coughed and spat and massaged his throat and crawled dazily into a corner where he turned and looked back fearfully at the spot where the blood-eyed, fanged, furious stranger had been standing. But of course, the necroscope was no longer there. No one was there. And again the clerk gargled,
"My God! My God! Good God!"
Working from his list alphabetically, Harry had already investigated three Fridge's depots and installations. The vehicle depot at Anwick, the slaughterhouse and meat dressing station in Bishop Auckland, and lastly the freezer complex in Darlington. So far, he had copied the addresses of four possibles, all of them John's or Johnny's, and all drivers for the firm. Now, however, with the morning only halfway through, the weird mind cry out of nowhere had disturbed him, damaged his resolve and destroyed his concentration to such an extent that he took the Mobius route home to Bonnyrigg and from there contacted Trevor Jordan at the castle on the Mount in Edinburgh.
"Harry?"
Jordan came back at once, his telepathic voice full of his relief that the necroscope was in touch again.
"I tried to reach you, but your mind smog was too dense and getting thicker all the time. Can you come and get me? I think I may have a lead."
Harry nodded, just as if he was speaking to someone directly in front of him and not 10 miles away, and said,
"Do you know the Laird's Larder? It's a coffee shop up there just off the Royal Mile. Ask anyone and they'll direct you. I'll be there in 5 minutes. But Trevor, tell me, has anything peculiar happened? Have you felt anything strange? Do I need to be, well, more than usually careful how I move?"
"Watcher, you mean? The branch?"
A mental shake of the other's head.
"Not that I've detected. Maybe a tentative touch now and then, but nothing you could nail down. Nothing concentrated, anyway. If they have people up here, then they're too good for me, and I'm pretty damn good. No static? Paxton, maybe?"
"I don't feel any static. Distantly, maybe, but nothing local. As for Paxton, I'm sure I'd be able to pick him up 20 miles away. And you?"
"Just an experience,"
Harry answered, "in Darlington."
"Darlington?"
The necroscope could almost see the other's eyebrows going up.
"Now there's a coincidence. And did you find any Johnnies in Darlington?"
Harry was intrigued.
"Two," he replied, "and one of them a real life Johnny. That's how he spells his name, anyway. Johnny Courtney. The other is called John Found."
And now he pictured Jordan's grim nod as the telepath said,
"Yes, and Dragasani was a foundling too, wasn't he?"
Harry said,
"Is that supposed to mean something?"
He knew it was.
"Better believe it," Jordan confirmed. "See you outside the Laird's Larder," Harry told him. 5 minutes.
He waited out the 5 minutes in a fever of anticipation, then made it 6 to be sure Jordan had got there. And finally Mobius tripped to the steep, cobbled road just off the Royal Mile. He emerged from the continuum on a crowded, bustling pavement where tourists and locals alike were clustered like bees in a hive, jostling and filled with purpose as they went about their various businesses. No one noticed that Harry was suddenly there. People loomed everywhere, from every direction, sidestepping each other. The necroscope was just another face in the crowd. Jordan was in the doorway of the Laird's Larder. He spotted Harry, grabbed his elbow, and guided him off the street into the shade. Harry was glad of that, for the sun was out and it had grown to be more than mere irritation. He now actively hated it. "Buy 3 sandwiches, he told the telepath. "Steak for me, and rare if they got it, whatever you like for yourself, and anything with plenty of bread around it for the third, okay? Mystified, Jordan nodded and went to the busy counter. He ordered, was served, and came back to Harry, where he waited. Harry took his arm and said, "Close your eyes," and ushered him through a Mobius door. To anyone watching, it would look like they just stepped out of the coffee shop into the street, except they didn't arrive in the street. Instead, a moment later, they emerged 2 miles away by the lake on the crest of the vast volcanic outcrop called Arthur's Seat. There was an empty bench where they sat down a while and ate in silence, and Harry tore up the third sandwich into small pieces, which he fed to the ducks and a lone swan that came paddling to the feast. And eventually, the necroscope said, "Tell me about it." But Jordan answered, "You first. What's all this about an experience in Darlington? You sounded like something had worried you, Harry. Something other than finding a couple of suspect Johnnies, that is. And I mean, tracking this maniac down is important. No one would deny that. But there's such a thing as personal safety, too. So you better tell me, are there going to be problems?"
"Oh, yes," Harry answered. "And soon. Something inside tells me that not even Darcy Clark can do anything about that.
But that's not what this was about." And, as best he could, he explained what he had felt and told Jordan how his mother had reacted to the death of a small dog.
"You think someone's died this morning? Any idea who?"
Harry shook his head.
"Someone cried out to me, that's all. I think so, anyway. And you're dead speak. Can't you make inquiries?"
Harry gave a wry snort. "The majority don't want to know me," he answered. "Not now. Not any longer. I can't say I blame them." He shrugged, then brightened a little. "On the other hand, if someone did die and still wants to contact me, then pretty soon he'll be able to do just that."
"Oh? Through Deadspeak," Harry explained. "Except he'll have to contact me in person, for I won't know where to start looking, and it will have to be by night. During the daylight hours, the sun interferes too much. If not for this hat of mine, I'd be in trouble. Even with the hat, I feel tired, sick, unable to think straight. There were a few clouds earlier, but they're clearing, and the brighter it gets, the duller I get."
He stood up and threw the last handful of crumbs onto the surface of the lake between the crags.
"Let's get out of here. I could use some shade."
They took the Mobius route to the gloomy old house on the outskirts of Bonnyrigg, then telepathically probed the countryside all around.
"Nothing," Jordan declared, and Harry agreed.
And finally,
"All right."
The necroscope threw off his hat and sprawled gratefully in an easy chair.
"Now it's your turn. Just what did you discover up there at the castle? I can tell that something's excited you."
"You're right," Jordan grinned. "It was my chance to pay you back, Harry, for what you've done for me, for my life, my resurrection.
God, I'm alive, and I know how wonderful it is, so I wanted things to work out. You could say I almost willed it to happen, and it did."
"You think you've found our man or monster?" Harry leaned forward eagerly in his chair.
"I'm pretty sure I have," the telepath answered. "Yes, I'm pretty damn sure."
Chapter 3. Johnny Found.
"I showed my E-Branch ID at the guardroom," Jordan commenced his story, "and told them I was investigating the death of a girl who was found under the walls. I said we'd had our wires crossed the first time, because she wasn't who we thought she was, which was why we were looking into it again from square one. The squad is on duty had read all about it in the newspapers, and anyway, I wasn't the first investigator they'd seen, not even the first today. They told me that in fact there were already 2 plainclothes men in the castle, down in the sergeant's mess. That piece of information stopped me dead for a second or two while I considered it. But then I thought, what the hell? For after all, I was E-Branch, wasn't I? Well, I had been until very recently. Anyway, I never had any problems dealing with the law. In fact, the police had always shown me, and E-Branch in general, a lot of respect, and vice versa. So I asked directions to the warrant officers and sergeant's mess and made my way there. Edinburgh Castle is a massive place, the greater part of which is never ever glimpsed by the tourists and general public. Your average tourist knows that the castle esplanade is where they hold the Edinburgh Tattoo,
with room to build a stadium of 8,000 seats, royal boxes and all, and a hard standing that takes the military's massed bands, motorcycles and other vehicular displays, shows from all round the world, you name it. But the vast stone complex beyond Mons Meg, the 1 o'clock gun, the Ye Olde Tea Shoppy, or whatever it is they've named that cafe in the crag, remains a mystery to most people. And where the way is roped off, that's where the real castle begins. But you've been there, Harry, and you know that it's like, well, a maze of alleys and gauntlets and courtyards. A fantastic place, and one that's easy to lose your way in. Eventually, I found the sergeant's mess and the two jock plainclothes officers who were talking to Sergeant Cook and his civilian assistants and jotting down a few notes. I showed my ID and asked if I could sit in on their questioning, and they didn't bat an eyelid between them. They knew how the branch, in the shape of Darcy Clark and yourself, Harry, had been helping out with the job. Anyway, I'd arrived right on cue because they were asking about the night of the murder, especially about any deliveries of refrigerated meat which had been made to the cookhouse that night. Apparently, forensics had alerted them to beast blood on Penny's clothes, do you see? Well, you can imagine how it felt, Harry, to be right there when the cook sergeant got out his register of deliveries to check details of the beast's carcasses that had come in. Yes, from Frigis Express. Naturally, I said nothing. Just kept me ears wide open and my mouth tight shut and took in as much as I could get, which was quite a bit, because this overweight, red-faced, hot and bothered sergeant's mess cook was efficient to a fault. He not only kept a record of dates and times of all deliveries of foodstuffs and copies of his own countersigned receipts, which bore the signatures of his suppliers, but he even had the registration numbers of delivery vehicles too. And naturally I made a mental note of the number of the truck which had made the deliveries that night. This is how the system works. During the day, the Esplanade gets crowded, and anyway, Edinburgh's streets are no place for big articulated trucks during daylight hours, so Frigis Express delivers at night. Of course, big vehicles can't make it under the arch of the guardroom and up the narrow gauntlet, so they park down on the Esplanade and the cookhouse sends down a driver in a military Land Rover to collect the carcasses. The Frigis driver passes the meat straight out from the back of his truck and into the back of the Land Rover, which then conveys it up to the main cookhouse, and the Frigis driver goes up as a passenger in the Land Rover to get his docket signed. And sometimes he'll have a beer with a cook sergeant in his little office before walking back down to his truck on the dark Esplanade. By night, of course, the Esplanade is empty and he has plenty of room to turn the big vehicle round and get out of there. So, the plainclothes officers wanted to know if this had been the routine on the night of the murder. And it had. In fact, the cook sergeant knew his delivery man quite well. He worked for Frigis out of Darlington. Yes, Darlington, Harry, and made deliveries to the castle every 3 or 4 weeks, and when the sergeant was around, they'd usually have a pint together in his office. As for his name, well, his signature was a scrawl, quite unreadable, possibly even disguised, all except for the F, which started his surname. But the fat sergeant was willing to swear that he referred to himself as, that's right, Johnny. Well, that was about it. When the officers were satisfied with what they got, I came out with them. Along the way, I made mention of how they seemed to be doing okay with E Branch on this one. It was pretty obvious they weren't exactly sure what the branch is all about. Well, who is, except the branch members? But they guessed we were some sort of higher echelon intelligence organisation which fools about, however successfully, with psychic stuff, table rapping and divining and such. And I suppose in a way they were right at that. Then we spent a little time looking over the wall in various places and down on the gardens towards Prince's Street, and sure enough, there are places you could dump a body without breaking its bones. The jocks seemed especially interested in looking down on one spot, and I guess that was where Penny had been found. A peep inside their minds told me I was right. Finally, as I parted company with them on the Esplanade, I said, "We'll be in touch, and if this Johnny bloke doesn't work out the way you..." But one of them broke in on me. "Oh, we're pretty sure he's the one, and we can wait a few days longer. Actually, we'd like to catch this bastard in the act of picking up some girl before we move in on him. He's been doing these jobs of his thick and fast, so we think he'll try it on again the next time out. Another day or two at most. And you better believe we'll be right behind him. Then he shrugged and let it go at that. So I told them good luck, and that was it. I felt great, great to be alive, and even better that I'd made a dent in the case, and so had a beer at the Royal Mail, following which I just waited around for you to contact me. End of story. The necroscope seemed a little disappointed. You didn't get a general description of this man, or discover when he's driving for Fridges again. These things weren't in their thoughts, Jordan answered, shaking his head. And anyway, if I'd had to concentrate on scanning their minds, I might have slipped up, done something stupid, given myself away. Remember, you and I are both telepaths. When we read each other, and it comes over strong and true, that's because we're doing it deliberately. But reading the mind of an ordinary person is different. They're cluttered things, minds, and rarely concentrate on anything for more than a moment or two. Harry nodded. I didn't mean to put you down. What you've done is wonderful. It's worked out perfectly so far. But now I want to find out something about this man's background. Like why he's the way he is. Such knowledge might be of use, that's all. If not me, to E-Branch, after I've gone. Also, I'm curious about his name. You said something about Dragosani also being a foundling. Well, maybe there's more to that than you thought or intended. So, I have one or two things to learn about this Johnny Found, and of course, I want to get to him before the police. He'd be charged with murder, I know, but what he's done and would still do is worth a lot more than that. He came on very cruel, and that's how he should go out. The necroscope's voice as he finished speaking was a deep growl, sinking deeper all the time. Jordan was happy to keep out of his mind, but he couldn't help thinking to himself, Mr. Johnny Found, whoever, whatever, or whyever you are, I wouldn't be in your shoes for all the gold in Fort Knox. Ben Trask had called his briefing for 2 p.m, and all available E-Branch operatives were present. The minister responsible was there too, accompanied by Geoffrey Paxton, who Trask really hadn't expected to see. But he made no fuss about it. It had dawned on him that the job was too important to let personalities interfere. It just struck him as incongruous that while a low-life specimen such as Paxton was safe and legitimate, the good stuff such as Harry Keogh had crashed foul of fate and was about to become a victim of his own methods. Sure, for it had been Harry who showed the branch how to do this sort of thing. How to set it up, what weapons to use, the stake, the sword, the fire, and how to strike, in order to kill vampires. When everyone was present, Trask wasted no time but got right down to it. By now, all of you know what Harry Keogh has become, he began, which is to say he's the most dangerous creature who ever lived. Partly because he carries this plague of vampirism, which could consume all of us, for which there's no cure. Well, there have been others before Harry, and they all succumbed, usually to the necroscope himself, and that's the rest of what makes him so dangerous. He knows all about it, about us, about just about everything. Now, don't get me wrong, he isn't a Superman and never has been, but he is the next best thing. Which was great when he was on our side, but isn't quite so hot right now. Oh yes, and unlike the other vampires the branch has dealt with, Harry will know we're after him. He let that sink in, then continued. Some other things that make him dangerous. He's become a telepath, so from now on, all of you thought thieves, keep a close watch on your minds. If not, Harry will be in there. And if he knows what you're doing as you're doing it, then he won't be waiting around for it to happen, right? He's a teleport, too, and uses something called the Mobius Continuum to come and go as he pleases. He can be literally anywhere he wants to be, instantaneously. Think about that. Last but not least, that we know of, anyway, Harry is now a necromancer, no less than Dragosani was. No, more than Dragosani was, because Dragosani only examined his victims. Harry, on the other hand, can bring them back from the dead, even from their ashes, we think, as vampires, and, as such, obviously they'd be working for him. So, what I'm saying is that everything he's previously achieved has now been totally reversed. He is our target, Harry and anyone who works with him. A lot of you will be wondering about Darcy Clark, so let me put you in the picture. Darcy died by accident. Trask at once held up a restraining hand, because he'd seen faces beginning to tighten and mouths opening questioningly. "It was an accident of sorts," he repeated, "and in its way understandable, if not entirely acceptable. Now, I've had to do a lot of soul-searching myself in order to come to terms with this, and so I can readily understand your confusion. But Darcy had been changed. He must have been, else we couldn't have killed him. That's right, I said we, the branch. If he'd lived, he would have been our weakest link, and sooner or later we'd be obliged to deal with him anyway. But he isn't alive, and he can't be brought back, or interfered with, not where he is now, for we've had him cremated already, yes, and even now his ashes are being scattered. If he was one of Harry's people, which has to be said seems likely, then he isn't any more. Okay, I've said it was an accident, but the real accident, or more probably the tragedy, was that Darcy Clarke and Harry Keogh were friends, and that they'd had a lot of contact with one another. It's as simple as that. Harry's own accident happened to him in the Greek islands, or more likely in Romania, just a few weeks ago, since when it's taken him over completely, and conceivably unknown to Darcy, and just conceivably unknown or unrealised even by the necroscope himself, the thing, disease, contagion, whatever and however you think of it, somehow passed between them. That's the way we see it anyway. But the fact is that Darcy had a very bad case of mind smog, and he'd lost his guardian angel, the talon which had kept him secure through everything the branch had thrown at him all these years. As for Darcy working with Harry, well, we knew that he'd been passing him information, even before we knew for sure that he'd been changed. Just when these changes occurred isn't easy to tell. They might have been in the wind for some time, but they came to light just last night, for that was when Harry visited Darcy at home. He didn't stay long after he left. Then Darcy had mind smog. So that's what I meant when I said Darcy had been changed. When he died, he just wasn't Darcy Clarke anymore, not the one we all knew, and now he isn't anymore. But more important, he isn't and can never be a threat to the branch or to the world. Harry Keogh very definitely is, however, and so are the people we believe he's already contaminated. There are at least two of these, a young girl called Penny Sanderson, and the telepath we knew as Trevor Jordan. Again, he held up his hand. Yes, I know, Trevor was my friend too, and hell, he was also dead. But he isn't any more. Harry Keogh has resurrected both of these people from their ashes, which in itself must surely confirm what they've become. Undead. So, where does all this leave us? Plainly, it leaves us with a fight on our hands, and one which will take all the skills and efforts of every last one of us. Because if we don't win this one, then there won't be a last one of us. Now, here's how we're going to go about it. As of tonight, the Sanderson girl goes under covert surveillance. We're going to leave that to Special Branch. No Espers will be involved at this stage. Why? Because Keogh and Jordan would pick up on our people like they were radioactive. So it's the dear old British Bobby who will cover for us, but without really knowing what it's all about. Just another stakeout as far as they're concerned. Which should be safe enough, for as far as we know, the girls had no contact with Jordan or the necroscope since Harry, well, since he did whatever he did to bring her back. So we just let the Commodore Garden Law keep an eye on her until it's time, then call them off and finally move in. By which time we'll know how we're going to deal with her. Incidentally, if I seem cold-blooded about this, it's because that's how it has to be. I'm the only one who's left of the old crowd, which means I'm the only one who knows what hell is like. I saw it during the Badescu case, and out in the Greek islands, and anyone who thinks I'm exaggerating hasn't read the Keogh files or Darcy Clarke's report on the Greek thing. And if any one of you really hasn't read those items, then he bloody well better had, and now. Okay, so as of tonight, we'll have the girl covered, and she'll stay that way until we're all set. But she's small fry, and the big fish, the sharks, are still cruising. They're the ones we have to worry about. But how much do we have to worry about them? Well, let's talk about Jordan. This morning he was in Edinburgh, in the castle on the Mount, taking an interest in the serial killer case. Darcy Clarke had asked for the necroscope's help on this one, and it looks like Harry has hooked on it. Now he and Jordan seem to be working together on it. Don't ask me why, except that Penny Sanderson was one of the killer's victims. Revenge? It could well be, for vampires are like that. If so, then sooner or later, Harry and Co. may be having a go at this sex freak. As to how we know Jordan was in the castle, he just casually latched onto a couple of plain clothes men during their investigation up there. He was able to do it because he still had his branch ID. Later, when one of the investigators mentioned Jordan to a superior, the fact that E-Branch still had a man on this thing, his boss got straight on the phone to us saying thanks, but no thanks. They don't need our help anymore. They think they've already got their man. Well, at least we managed to obtain the suspect's name and address, which might come in very handy. Apparently, he's called John or Johnny Found and has a flat in Darlington. So there'd be some common or garden law watching Mr. Found too, and I'll be detailing someone to watch them, with a warning to stay well out of the picture for the moment, unless or until Keogh and Jordan decide to move on him. What else about Jordan? Well, as you know, Trevor was, I mean is, a pretty good telepath. It could be that that's where Harry got his new talent, for Harry's also a necromancer, remember? And, as such, he might be able to accumulate talents as he goes, much as Dragasani did. That's speculation, however, and still to be proven. Another thing about Jordan is this. He was always one hell of a nice bloke. Oh, I know there's no such thing as a nice vampire. You don't have to tell me that. But what I'm saying is I don't think evil will come naturally to him. It will probably be a gradual process. I hope so, anyway, because of course his vampirism will quickly enhance his already powerful telepathy, following which, well, put it this way, there won't be any sneaking up on him. All right, I'm almost through. You'll be detailed to your new tasks within the hour, as soon as I can get them worked out. Anything else you're busy with, drop it until you're told.